Well, welcome this morning. I'm so glad to have you with us. As always, our ushers are going to come forward and give us a chance to partner together financially. So if you came prepared to give, now is the time to do that. If you want to, in one of the very tangible ways of partnering with the mission that we're on here together. As they do that, I want to remind you that today is Kids Space. And so, for Kids Space, very excited about that. Kicks off at 3 p.m. today. And as a reminder, Kids Space is an event that we designed for parents and kids to come together. And where we centered around a character virtue. This time we're centering around the virtue of creativity. And so there's going to be all sorts of things outside. You will see a carnival extravaganza this afternoon of food and games and horse rides, all sorts of stuff. And then inside we'll have a 45-minute theatrical presentation and high-energy music and singing and dancing and drama and laughter, all that kind of stuff. So it'll be a great time in here. And so that's from 3 to 6 p.m. today. So really hope that you can make it out for that. Again, designed for parents and kids of elementary age and younger. That's what the event's designed for, but everybody's welcome. Also, wanted to let you know, while we're talking about kids, that a few weeks ago, I sent out kind of a email to our community and said, hey, I'm getting ready to speak to hundreds of our volunteers here at the church and to thank them for what they do. And so I would love to hear from you how Crosspoint has impacted you or you and your family. And so, man, I'm just so appreciative. I got flooded with just different emails and just where I said, hey, in a few sentences, could you just tell me how it's impacted you specifically and how this community's impacted you specifically? And so people wrote in. I want to share just a few of them with you. One, someone said, as a married mom of two boys who attends church without my spouse, I so appreciate all the volunteers who love on my boys each week. Having another adult to reinforce God's love and wisdom each week is priceless. Someone else wrote, in our previous experiences, our children would do just about anything to get out of going. Sunday was not the best day of the week. Now these same girls, ages 9 and 6, get up and ready to go. In fact, they are upset if we don't leave home in time to ensure they get a spot in their class. Really? Our girls now literally push us out the door on Sundays. Another parent wrote, and asked, how's Crosspoint impacted you? And said, the joy of having my kid rush from the car into church and race up the stairs every Sunday. And the reason that's happening and the reason families are being changed and kids are being changed is because we have volunteers in our church of people who say, you know what, I'm going to pour into and I'm going to love some kids. I'm going to walk with them. I'm going to be a third voice in their life that's going to partner with their parents in some way to help just reinforce the same kind of values and truth that they're trying to do at home. And we all know that. We talk about that in here all the time, how critically important it is for our kids to have a third voice in their life, somebody who's speaking into them and trying to reinforce the same types of things. If you'll notice in your program, we've got a blurb right here where it talks about that we need Kids Point small group leaders. So one of the reasons we've kind of come into that. If you're a parent of elementary school kid, you've noticed that thankfully we keep getting more and more elementary school age kids, which is awesome. And we've been busting out in terms of the seams, in terms of kids. And so we've had to shut down classrooms. And so what we've been doing is having to make a plan on how do we fit more kids in to say, you know, it's not acceptable that we're turning away kids, you know, week after week. And especially in this second service is probably the most crowded that it is. And we're like, it's just not acceptable that we'll continue to do that. So we can get creative all day long in terms of space. And so we've come up with a plan of how we can accept more kids into the class, into that experience. But really the hinge point of that is small group leaders. It's because what we can't sacrifice is that experience to say, we want to make sure that we have other adults that are pouring very intentionally into kids' lives. And so what we can come up with all the creative solutions space-wise, but what we need are some people to say, in order to make that happen, we've got to have some adults that'll say, you know what? Yeah, I'll invest in a kid. Or a high school student that will say, I'll invest in some elementary school age kids. And so, you know, one of the things that we've learned of what's so important just in our own family is that our own son, Caden, he's 9. We rearrange our morning schedule around so that he can be with his small group leader, that he's had the same one for the last several years and has followed with him and knows him. And we think that is so incredibly valuable, that consistency and that voice, and it makes such a tremendous difference. This past week, we had someone else come up and say, hey, was telling our upper elementary director, hey, you know, I've got to leave next year, so you can't count on me to be a small group leader and you need to make other plans in the class. And at first it was like, oh, something wrong. And she's like, no. Just, I've committed to my girls that I started with them in third grade and I'm going to take them all the way through high school. And that's awesome. I mean, that's just incredible to think about the value of having an adult to say, you know what, I'm going to be a consistent presence in their life all the way through. We have another adult. So what she does is she takes a group of kids from first grade as their small group leader all the way up to fifth grade. And then she passes them off to junior high and then she goes back because she's scared of junior high, which I don't blame her, you know, there. But then goes back to first grade, you know, and walks them all the way through up to fifth grade. Man, what a difference that makes. Such an incredible, incredible difference. And so we would love to have some adults that would help us do that. And we'll teach you and equip you and train you and make you great at that. But what you just need to do is saying, hey, I'll be available and I'll care. I can't teach people how to care. And I can't make you available, but we can resource you in every other way to be great at that. And so we would love to be a church community that's known as, you know what, we're really intentional about pouring into kids and being consistent voices in their life. So if you're interested in that, there's an email right there, the person that you need to contact, and they will get in touch with you, follow up with you, and help you every step of the way. A few months back, many of you know that my family and I traveled to Africa. And speaking of Africa, real quick, too, that there's announcements in your program as well. If you didn't notice that, there's two upcoming trips next summer that if you're interested in, you need to pay attention. There's some informational meetings coming up of how you can get involved with that. But my wife and I spent a couple of weeks really praying and wrestling through about the wisdom of taking our 7 and 9-year-old with us to Africa because they had never been on a plane before, let alone out of the country before, let alone to a third world country. And so we kind of wrestled through the wisdom of that. But at the end of the day, we felt like God was saying, yeah, you know what? I want you to take them. And so we said, okay. And so we took the 18 hours of flight over there, landed in Nairobi, Kenya at about 10:30 p.m. And after an exhausting day of flying, then we went to our hotel, we crashed, and then we had to wake up at 4:30 the next morning to catch another plane. So then we caught another plane, an inter-country flight, flew out to the middle of nowhere. After about an hour and a half, landed, got on another bus, and then we traveled an hour and a half to 2 hours, kind of along all these bumpy roads because no roads are smooth in Africa. And come to find out, you know, our kids are car sick when the roads get too bumpy. So, so we had one of these kind of moments where in the middle of this, it was like, did we make the wrong decision? You know, I don't know if we did the right thing. And both my wife and I came to kind of the conclusion and said, you know what, wait a second. Trusting God and following God and listening to God's voice in this moment does not equate to that it's going to be easy. God did not promise us free from difficulty in it. He didn't promise us a vomit-free journey, you know. He didn't promise us that. But what he did say is, yeah, I want you to go. And so, you know, and our kids, they did great in that moment. I mean, probably other people on the bus didn't even realize that they had these little Ziplocs, and they were just real quiet about it, and they kind of vomited in their little Ziploc bags and sealed that bad boy up. And but they still had this amazing attitude, and they were great. And we have kids just like normal kids, you know, they'll complain and whine, do all sorts of different things from time to time. But there was none of that in them. So we get out of the bus, and we hike 25 minutes up a rocky hill to get to where the village is at in African sun. And so then we finally get there and our kids just, they were amazing. I mean, they were amazing. They engaged all day long. And I mean, it's tough adjusting to kind of being a celebrity. They were the first white kids ever in the history of the village to set foot in this remote village in Africa. And so you've got kids all, you know, just fascinated by them, wanting to touch their hair and see them. And I mean, so they handled all that really well. And they spent time in people's homes and they just listened and they loved and they talked and they taught people games and other kids games. They just had a great, great time. I was so, so incredibly proud of them. And so at the end of the first day, we walk back down the hill. We hike about 25 minutes and we get to our bus. And we get back in the bus that's going to take us back to the place where we're staying. And I've got my arm around my oldest son, Caden, who's 9. And we're sitting there in the car. And he's quiet. But about 15 minutes in, he looks up at me and he says, Dad, you know, they think we have so much in America. But they're the ones with so much. And I said, buddy, so what do you mean by that? And he said, you know, they hardly have anything. They don't have any toys. Most of them don't have shoes, hardly any food, but they're content. They're happy. And it's one of those moments that you just want to kind of capture as a parent you know, if you could just capture it and say, could you just say that again in this video camera, you know, so that when we get back home, I can remind you of this. But yeah, but just one of those moments. And it was like, okay, this is exactly what we were supposed to be doing. And God exactly wanted our kids' hearts experiencing this in this particular moment. But I wanted to capture it because it puts flesh on something deep down that we all know is true. Jesus says this in Luke chapter 12. He says, watch out. Now, when Jesus says watch out here, we tend to think kind of in America that when someone says that, it's kind of a threatening of fear. You know, watch out and screaming. But that's not really the heart of this. The Greek there is this simply that you would see, that you would observe, that you would pay attention. See, look, observe. It says, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. This is what Jesus is always doing. Jesus is always saying, pay attention to what's going on inside of you. See what's going on in your heart. And then he says this, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Now, I don't care what your background is. I don't care what you believe or what you don't believe, what religious background you have or don't or do have. We all know that's true. All of us do. It's not true because Jesus said it. Jesus says it because it's true. It's the reason that the song that we just sang is so popular in culture and has become this anthem for so many in culture, because we recognize and know that's true. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. So we know that there's beauty in that. We know that there's truth in that. And visiting places like Matura and Africa remind us that it is actually possible to live that way. But the thing is, we all know that cognitively. I mean, we can all find ourselves agreeing with what Jesus says here. But many of us tend to operate from a different place. Often we live and make decisions at a gut level or an emotional level, at a reactionary level. And by not stopping to pay attention to what's actually going on in our hearts, we can find that we actually live in opposition to what Jesus taught, to what Jesus said. And we find that we're driven by this sense that our lives, in fact, at an emotional kind of gut level, we think it does consist in the abundance of our possessions. And so obviously we do that with stuff. We do that with things. After all, I mean, we understand. All of us understand in this room. We live in a culture whose entire marketing strategy is built upon the premise of you can't be happy, you can't be complete unless you have this product. We're smart people here in Cary, North Carolina. We understand that. We know that's what's going on. But still, we can find ourselves falling prey to having to have more, to feeling like we can't be happy without this thing or without that thing. But again, I think most of us know that. We're aware of that. We know that's what's going on inside of us. And so I don't want to spend the rest of our time this morning talking to you about how to address this longing that you have for more and more stuff, and to make that to make you aware that that's going on inside of you, because you already know that. I want to deal with the reality this morning that our obsession with more doesn't just have to do with stuff. I want us to stop and pay attention to that. Because what we discover is that many of us, we want more things to go our way. What really drives us is we want more people to see things the way that we do. We want more attention. We want more love. We want more respect. We want more responsibility. We want more titles. We want more power. And we find ourselves longing for it. We long for it. And when we don't get it, we get frustrated. We get frustrated at circumstances. We get frustrated at other people. And what begins to happen is we find ourselves walking around with this raging sense of disappointment that's always boiling right at the surface that we can never seem to shake. And if you're not careful, what happens is you find yourself spilling out into all sorts of conflict. This raging sense of disappointment, it spills out on all sorts of different people in your life. James, the brother of Jesus, he had some further insight to this. Look at what he writes, James chapter 4, verse 1. He says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? James says, if you're wondering where this sense of angst and conflict starts, it starts by being aware of what's actually going on in you. He says next, verse 2, you want something but don't get it. You kill and covet. Now, this idea of covet, it's a word that we don't use very often in language today. But it carries with it, this isn't just merely wanting something. This carries with it this idea that you lust after it, that you feel entitled to it, that you feel like you have a right to demand it. He says, you kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want, so you quarrel and fight. Now, at first, what James says here may not sound all that profound. I mean, because when we think about what causes fights and arguments we get into, at first it sounds like way too general of a question. And you're like, what do you mean what causes fights and quarrels? I mean, all sorts of things. There's all sorts of different factors. He didn't do what he was supposed to do. She didn't do what she was supposed to do. He said this, she said that. Didn't do what they were supposed to do. He failed, you know, she dropped the ball. There's all these different reasons and things that we play into that factor in our minds of what actually causes the conflict and the anger that we're feeling. And yet James boils it all down to boils this very general question, seemingly, to a very simple answer. James says, no, listen. The reason there's fights and arguments among you is because you're not getting what you want. That's why. One answer. The reason for all of it is because you're not getting what you want. He says, that's it. Now, that may not sound profound at first to you, but I want you to understand the weight of what he's saying, because it is so true. James says, the reason that you're mad, the reason that you're hacked off at your spouse, at your parents, at your kids, it's because you're not getting what you want. It's just the reason you're mad at your in-law, at your teacher, at your boss, at your employee, at your ex, at your neighbor. It's because you're not getting what you want. The reason you're mad at your coach, at the president, the reason that you're mad at that athlete on TV that you've never met before, the reason that you're mad at the stranger who won't stop talking while you're trying to enjoy some quiet, the reason you're mad is because you're not getting what you want. That's the reason. Believe it or not, that really is the root of your conflict. So if you have kids and the next time they start fighting, before you do anything else, try this. Say, okay, here's what I want you to do. Okay, sit down. I want you to each repeat this before we talk about this anymore. Here's what I want you to repeat. The problem here is I'm not getting what I want. Have each of them repeat that. The problem here is I'm not getting what I want. Now, understand, doing that alone doesn't solve everything, but it is the best place to start. Because when you start there, what happens is everyone starts with at least an acceptance of some responsibility. That the root of the reason that I'm frustrated or that I am angry right now is because I'm not getting what I want. And again, the same holds true when you find yourself mad at your spouse or your manager or some stranger in traffic. If you want to tackle the problem from the right starting place, it's with an awareness of what's going on in your heart. It's an admission that if even only to yourself, that the core problem is, I'm not getting what I want. And I'm telling you, more than anything else that I know of, that begins to de-escalate what's fuming inside of you. It's not saying that it solves it, but what it does do is it absolutely starts moving you in a much healthier direction where you can begin to see and when you can begin to recognize that your anxiety and your anger are often a blinding to your own demands. That it's blindness to your own demands of all these emotions that are coming up and boiling up to the surface, that it's really an issue of you're not getting what you want. Because until you do that, until you recognize that, until you own your own share of the problem, your first reaction and my first reaction, our first impulse will typically be to blame someone else. That's what we do. But understand, blaming never resolves anything. Again, we know that cognitively, but impulsively, it's easy to live there. But all blaming ever does, all it ever does is simply feed the problem and make things worse. Andy Stanley writes about blame in one of his recent books. He says this, you got to pay attention to this because this is gold. It says, blame is an admission that I can't be happy without your cooperation. Blame is an admission that I can't be happy without your cooperation. To blame is to acknowledge dependence. If you don't act a certain way, I can't be satisfied or content. Now, take a moment and try to play that out logically to an extreme. Understand, when you do that, you'll never be happy until you're able to control the actions and reactions of everybody else. But you see, if we don't realize that's what's happening inside of us, our default becomes we try to squeeze our happiness and contentment out of the other people around us. That we focus all of our time and energy. How do I get happiness from other people? How do I get the contentment I want from other people? Which at a very foundational level, understand, makes it impossible to love them. Because what we're actually doing is we're trying to get something we want from them. And so we take this disguise of love and it really is manipulation. We do it with kids, we do it with spouses, we do it with friends, we do it with parents, we do it with people all the time. Now, the vicious cycle of this mentality is that often other people are doing the exact same thing. They're trying to squeeze their happiness and their contentment out of you. And so eventually everyone suffocates and we walk away convinced that the problem is someone else. We walk away always convinced that it's someone else's fault. Now, not surprisingly, we do the same thing with God. We get mad, we get frustrated, we don't get what we want, and we find ourselves struggling to actually love God because our goal isn't actually to know God, to know God's heart. Our goal isn't to learn to trust God and to trust his leadership. Instead, it becomes about trying to get something from God. And it becomes this game of sorts, trying to figure out the right formula or the right combination of religious hoops to unlock the specific blessings that we want to get from God. But along the way, what ends up happening is we actually end up missing God. We miss Jesus. Because our focus is, I'm not getting what I want. And we find ourselves obsessed with it. Obsessed with how do I get more and more of what I want, and frustrated that we can't get it. All of which brings us back to the Decalogue in Exodus chapter 20. That's where we've been the last 9 weeks. We've been walking through what's traditionally known as the Ten Commandments. And today, we finally arrive at number 10. It reads this way. Exodus chapter 20, verse 17. Says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. You shall not covet. Now, one of the most interesting things about this 10th one, you shall not covet, is that it's the only one out of the 10 that's not externally observable. That the other 9 you can see and measure in some way, but the 10th one is different. You ever think about that? It's internal. It can't really be measured by objective means. Now, one of the things we've mentioned throughout this series is that in Hebrew, the original language that these were spoken in, these aren't called the Ten Commandments. Rather, they're called the Ten Words or the Ten Utterances or even the Ten Proclamations. And for thousands of years, there's been speculation among Hebrew scholars and rabbis that perhaps the reason number 10 is different than the other 9 is that rather than it being an instruction not to do something, a life of not coveting is actually the reward one receives for obeying the other 9. That when you live the other 9, what happens is you won't end up coveting. That's your reward. You're free. You're no longer enslaved by wanting more. Now, here's a couple ideas to support that theory. One is that later in the New Testament, Jesus is speaking to someone who asked him a question about being good. And Jesus says this, Mark chapter 10, verse 19. He says, "You know the commandments." Then what Jesus does is he proceeds to list the ones that deal primarily with how you interact with other people. He goes back to the Ten Commandments and he walks through the back half of them. He says, "Do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not give false testimony, do not defraud, honor your father and mother." So what Jesus does is he walks through commands 5 through 9. But interestingly enough, he leaves off number 10, do not covet. And perhaps, not saying that it's the case, but perhaps it's because number 10 isn't meant to be understood as a commandment necessarily in the way that we tend to think about it, that it's something else. Additionally, in the Hebrew language, understand the words shall and will are interchangeable, same word. So it can get translated as shall or will. So it's plausible that upon trusting God's leadership in the first 9 ways, the first 9 words, first 9 commands, what God is trying to say is the reward is then you will not covet. See, that carries with it kind of a different connotation rather than you shall not covet. But what if 10 is you will not covet? You do these 9, you will not covet. You will not covet your neighbor's wife or anything that belongs to your neighbor. That's the reward. This won't happen. It's possible God is saying that when you choose to trust me, you won't covet. Now, please hear me on this. This isn't God saying you'll never want anything. God's not saying desire is wrong at all. God has given us desires. God is not saying ambition is wrong. Scriptures say selfish ambition is wrong, but ambition is a good thing. Drive is a good thing. That's not what God's saying here. He's saying, no, this is God saying, when you trust me, when you obey me, what happens is you won't feel entitled to things that won't belong to you. You won't be consumed with chasing after things and this endless pursuit of more. You won't find yourself demanding more. You'll be content. That you won't find yourself longing for someone else's life. I mean, wouldn't that be awesome? You wouldn't find yourself longing for someone else's life. I mean, some of you, you've already gone through that this morning. Driving here on the way, you saw someone else's car and you're like, oh. Some of you, you listen to someone else sing well and there's something in you that's just like, oh, if only I had some kind of talent like that. Some of you see somebody in your road this morning already and you're like, oh, if I could just dress like that, or if I had clothes like that, if I could just look like that. It's this constant battle within us. But what if? What would it be like to be free from that? To be free. What if the Decalogue is putting on display that when you trust God in these ways, the reward is you'll no longer buy into the myth that the good life always belongs to somebody else? That if you could just get more of what you think you deserve, then you'd be happy. If you could just get more respect or more affection, if you could just get more affirmation or more significance or more prominence, if you could just get more stuff or more talent, then you'd be happy. Then you'd be content. What if these 10 words, these 10 utterances are leading us to understand that when you trust God, the reward is that you wouldn't buy into the myth that the real significant stuff happening in the world, the places where God is really acting and active and moving, is someplace other than where God actually has you right now. That you no longer buy into the myth that where God is active and moving is someplace other than where he has you right now. In your cubicle, behind a school desk, changing diapers, folding laundry, throwing football with your kids in the backyard. Perhaps what's enslaved you most is this idea that life, that real life could be found if you could just find a way, if you could just find a way to get more of what you're convinced you deserve, what you're convinced you're entitled to. And God wants you to be free. He wants you to be free from that. mean, we've said all along that God didn't give the Ten Commandments, and God doesn't give any commands. The heart of God is not to give any commands so that he can try to make bad people good. The heart of the Ten Commandments and the heart of any command given us by God is so that he can help keep free people free. He's not trying to make bad people good. He's trying to keep free people free. He's trying to get you to understand that you are already free. That's why we said at the very beginning when it starts off, the Ten Commandments, it says, I am the God who rescued you out of Egypt. Before they did anything, before they deserved anything, God stepped in and rescued them and freed them. And then says, okay, these aren't conditions. This isn't conditions for a relationship with me. I've already established relationship with you. I took the initiative. I rescued you and freed you because I love you. Here's how to live life so that you can stay free. So think through the Ten Commandments with me for a moment. Let's think through them. What would it look like to trust God's heart for us? To trust that the commands that he gave us were fueled out of love for us, out of his desire to lead us into life. What if you and I lived with such a sense of trust that we could say this? Let's think through them. You know, I'm not going to grab some other deity to take care of me. I'm not going to surrender to any other god or idol, literally or figuratively. I'm not going to buy into any misrepresentation of God's heart. Rather, I'm going to trust God. I'm going to trust God's heart for me. And I won't believe this lie that I can never stop and rest if I want to get ahead. I'm not going to buy into this lie that somehow my worth depends on what I produce. I'm not going to buy into this myth that somehow God is most honored when I never slow down. I'm not going to believe that anymore. I won't live my life demanding respect from other people, trying to take the honor and the respect that I think that I deserve, but rather I'm going to make the intentional choice to give it, to give honor. I won't take other people's lives. I won't become convinced that anger is the best way to get people to take me seriously and to get my way. I won't use people pharmaceutically to feel better about myself. I'm not going to choose to treat other people as possessions. I won't live as a parasite, always living my life focused on taking from others rather than reflecting the heart of my Father, which is to give. I won't lie. I won't try to hide reality. I won't perpetuate more darkness in the world based on false assumptions. I won't use other people's reputations as a way of repositioning my own. Then imagine, number 10, then you'd be free. If you lived life that way, you'd be free. You'd be free from using other people as a constant metric for your value and worth. Imagine if we actually trusted God's heart for us and chose to trust his leadership in these ways. And there would be such an incredible sense of peace and freedom that there wouldn't be any part of us that would covet after someone else's things, that would lust after someone else's life. With the passing of Steve Jobs this week, it seemed timely when I came across something he said to a group of graduating Stanford students years ago. He said this, "Your time is limited. Don't waste it living someone else's life." He says, your time is limited. Don't waste it. Don't waste it living someone else's life. And I think God would say the very same thing to us. And it's something that we need to be reminded of. It speaks right to the heart of what God wants us to understand when he invites us to trust him, that he is always leading us toward contentment, that he is always leading us toward life. And so may we be the kind of people who have the courage to actually let him lead. And that we would discover the kind of freedom that awaits. May we be the kind of people who take the way of God seriously. May we be the kind of people who trust his heart. And that we would allow him to lead us into the freedom that he is pointing us toward. So let's pray. Father, I thank you for these last several weeks that we've had to walk through these 10 words, these 10 commands. For so many of us, I know that for so long they've rested in our mind kind of as this list of words on a poster, this thing, this document, these words to argue about where they can get placed or not placed, this sense of moral right and wrong and authority and all these things. And God, in the process, what we've done is we've missed your heart. We've missed that what you're doing is trying to lead your children to freedom, all of your children to freedom. And so I pray that these last several weeks would capture our hearts for that, would remind us of that. And we would rediscover your heart, and in the process that we would rediscover what it means to trust you and allow you to lead. Father, thank you for the freedom that you have created for us. Thank you for initiating relationship with us, that you don't place obedience in terms of conditions on a relationship with you, but that you've already freed us, you've already rescued us. We are your children, so help us to step into that reality and live in it. We pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Thanks, friends. See you next week.